the Moan Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. California's primary is just over 7 months away. With word from Congress that Russia's election meddling was far more reaching than we previously thought, how secure are we as a state? Plus, your second most important purchase if you want to bike around L.A.
All right, let's start smacking
Let's do some shake. Exactly. Shake that head.
Yep. We're going helmet shopping. It's ahead on Take Two. Stay with us.
This is Larry Mantle. Join me for our next Film Week screening, Boogie Nights, 1970s LA's porn industry in transition. Saturday night, July 27th at the Theater at Ace Hotel. Tickets at kpcc.org/in-person.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. Me, Martinez. It's Friday. You haven't melted out there yet. To quote the song, you're gonna make it after all. I would have sung it, but I want you to stay tuned, so no one wants to hear that. All right, coming up, in a first, state utilities agree to pay into a fund to offset wildfire costs. We'll talk about why and how it'll work. Plus, you may have noticed the many Peruvian restaurants around Los Angeles. We're gonna give you a glimpse into the community behind them, so stay tuned for that. First, though, it is State of Affairs. It's our weekly peek at politics in the Golden State. And this week, the Senate Intelligence Committee says Russia targeted all 50 states during the 2016 election. We're going to check in on election security efforts. Meanwhile, with Robert Mueller's testimony out of the way, what will it all mean for Nancy Pelosi and calls for impeachment? We're going to get some answers from Rafe Sonnenschein. He directs the Pat Brown Institute at Cal State LA. Good to see you, Rafe.
Good to be with you, eh?
Also with us, Christina Bellantoni, professor at USC's Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism. Christina, welcome me as well.
Greetings.
All right, let's start with a look at that report from the Senate Intelligence Committee. We knew there was Russian interference in our election. It elaborates on just how much there was. Christina, what's in that report?
Well, the committee, this is the New York Times, kind of details lots of different things about the report, which actually is very heavily redacted. Even some of the recommendations for preventing such problems in the future are redacted. But the New York Times says that the committee described an unprecedented level of activity against state election infrastructure. And look, this shouldn't be a surprise to anyone who's been paying attention, but it is an alarm bell that Congress is so caught up in partisan politics that they are not really adequately addressing something ahead of what's going to be a really important election season that's coming right up.
And Christina, when I asked you what's in it, I was fully expecting to hear a lot of black ink.
Yeah, exactly. We think it was blank. You know, some of the subtitles on this report were even redacted, and it's actually the first of several reports that the committee is going to release. And I think it's important to point out this is a committee that interacts and actually functions really well on a bipartisan level. I mean, we see that that tends to happen a little bit more in the Senate anyway, just because of the nature of the body. But Senator Mark Warner of Virginia, Democrat, and Richard Burr, Republican from North Carolina, really have been pretty uniform in their reaction and response to all of the issues that have been brought up since 2016 when it comes to Russian interference, when it comes to Comey, when it comes to the Mueller report. They haven't really differed, and they haven't made it about partisan infighting, which obviously is very different from the House and what I imagine we're going to get to talking about the Mueller testimony.
And Rafe, California has known that its election was probed by Russians, but Secretary of State Alex Padilla has said that real help on the federal level is needed to ensure security. What kind of help could be offered at that level?
Well, clearly the states need to know what's going on, what attacks are being made on them. And there was an attempt during the Obama years for the federal government to offer more of that information and to get more involved. A lot of the states pushed back and said this was interference with the autonomy of the states. So mm-hmm. that effort kind of took a step back.
And that's Mitch McConnell's argument, too, right?
It is. It's not a very good argument, but it is an argument. And I think that technical help is overwhelmingly necessary. We have, not in California necessarily, but our states very often have very antiquated voting systems. And it's a quirk of our system that elections that are national in scope are administered by states who have wildly varying and often horrifyingly difficult systems to keep secure.
It would make sense that each state, for state elections, maybe might have their own thing. But if it is something that's going to cover from sea to shining sea, you would think there'd be some uniformity.
You would think.
Yeah. That, so then given those challenges, Rafe, do you see Congress coming together on this?
Well, No. Now, I would say I would definitely think that what Christina said is really important. If there's one committee to watch, it's the Senate Intelligence Committee. They're the most credible committee because the two chairs have been working together now for quite some time and are willing to challenge the administration and are willing to work in a bipartisan fashion. So people pay a lot of attention to what they come up with. Now, Mitch McConnell, the Senate leader, the Senate Majority Leader, was confronted in the Obama years with reports about Russian interference, and the president asked for a bipartisan explanation to the public of what was going on. And Senator McConnell famously said, if you do that, I will accuse you of partisanship and I will not go along with that. So a lot of that died. Since then, we have the problem that President Trump does not want any doubt cast on the legitimacy of his election. And we have read accounts in legitimate sources that security officials are reluctant to brief him on threats to the election system in 2016 because apparently he becomes very unhappy taking the next step and saying, are you casting doubt on my election? So McConnell is backing the president there, but also has shown in the past not much interest in bolstering these systems against Russian and other foreign interference.
Well, Christina, tick-tock, because the California primary is just 221 days away. How prepared and secure are we?
Look, you know, California officials say that they're being super vigilant. They've talked about actually investing their own money because they were only given, it sounds like a good amount of money, but really considering how many millions of voters we have, they were given $34 million by Congress for cybersecurity grants to states to look at these issues. But they also have 20-year-old technology. And so Alex Padilla, you know, talks about this a lot and the investments California has made, but also has talked about how for all of that technology, human error is still an issue. You know, he actually told the LA Times just a few months ago, if one member of our staff clicks on a link from a long lost uncle who just won the lottery and wants to transfer money, it's all compromised. And that doesn't instill a lot of confidence. And this is really important here because what Rafe just said is very interesting. Trump doesn't like anything that casts any question about the legitimacy of his own election in 2016. But you know what he does like to do? Repeatedly falsely claim that California had voter fraud in 2016. There is no evidence of that. When I was at the LA Times, we reported extensively debunking that claim that he made. And this is an area where the largest state, we know that it's vulnerable. It again just raises, it allows anyone to say that the election wasn't legitimate no matter what happens. And that could just be a huge problem for the largest and most populous state.
Well, Christina, one more thing on this, seeing as that you are the professor of communication and journalism in the room, are we paying enough attention to this? And is there room for journalists to cover this in a way that really gets to people to say, hey, you know what, this is more important than you might think?
Yeah, I mean, there's always room for better coverage, no doubt. I'm going to be teaching political reporting in the spring, and it's something that I'm going to make sure is part of that class because there have to be ways where we report about it in a way that is both interesting and engaging, but also not partisan. Because sometimes people just hear the words Russian interference and their brains shut off. They don't want to talk in that way about the elections, but everybody should want our election integrity to be maintained, going back all the way to when, you know, union bosses were getting dead people to vote. Like, no one should like that. That is something that undermines our democracy. And that's the message that I try to teach to our student journalists.
Rafe, what about you? Because if you compare the words impeachment and interference, impeachment just right now seems to be the sexier word.
Well, it's the word of the day. I think interference, anything involving the Russia investigation, has been a really hard story for the media to make interesting and engaging. I think that's a problem. I don't necessarily blame that on the media. I think whenever you're talking about protecting the system, it's a really hard story to do. So I actually think they maybe are doing better work on that in some ways than they are on the impeachment question, which I know we'll get to. But I think it's awfully hard to make this story clear, and yet it's a clear and present danger.
Talking to State of Affairs with Rafe Sonnenschein. He directs the Pat Brown Institute at Cal State LA. Also, Christina Bellantoni, professor at USC's Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism. All right, now, former special counsel Robert Mueller's testimony Wednesday was viewed by a lot of people, though he revealed little beyond the scope of the report. Among those watching closely were Democratic lawmakers who have pushed Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, on the issue of impeachment. Christina, does the testimony we saw this week, and we've had a few days now to kind of think about it and let it sink in, does it change the tone of the conversation at all in your view?
No. And, you know, Mueller, we kind of should have expected that, right, given his statement that he made when he said he was leaving this role in government service. He didn't reveal anything beyond what that report said, and he was never going to. And the strategy of both parties here really kind of baffles me. And I spent so many years in Washington, you kind of forget how disorganized politics is. And then when you're away from it for a while and I'm not actually reporting on it anymore, you know, you just wonder, like, did they not have a conversation ahead of time about, I don't know, building a series of questions that would kind of get at what you were looking for? You know, everybody uses these hearings to grandstand, but it was not a fine moment for our government. And it just really felt like, you know, partisanship after partisanship in a way that didn't help the underlying message, which is what we started at the beginning of this program. You know, there is a serious threat to our democracy, not just from Russia, from other countries as well who are trying to undermine our elections. That's a huge deal.
And Rafe, Mueller made it clear a long time ago that the report was his testimony. He doubled down.
Well, yeah, it was devastating and boring all at the same time, which is an amazing combination. But I think what the Democrats should have done is begun with part two as part one. They should have opened with the alleged crime, which is the interference, and then gone to the cover-up. So they should have had the Intelligence Committee go first and then the Judiciary Committee. That's actually how the Mueller report is written. And the first part is pretty shocking in terms of the Russia aspect of it. They didn't do that, so they end up looking at the cover-up and then the crime afterwards, which is confusing. However, I think the media in this case has not covered itself with glory. When the Mueller report came out, they sort of covered it. Then when the Attorney General gave a kind of odd interpretation of it, they declared the report was dead. Then they said, Mueller's coming, this is going to answer everything. Then immediately they said, he looks old and tired, and he's not very much fun to listen to, so therefore there's nothing in there worth doing. And meanwhile, very quietly, impeachment is moving on a different track through the House Judiciary Committee. And it's only now dribbling out that they are undertaking the beginnings of a pre-inquiry that does not require the full House majority to support. And that's why they're asking for grand jury testimony that they're allowed to do on a judicial enterprise. So once again, in this case, I sometimes think all of us miss the through line of the story about how things are moving forward. Certainly much too slowly for people who favor impeachment, but not dead in the water by any means because of the of certain, quote, optics of the Mueller presentation.
All right. Now that brings us to Congressman Adam Schiff. He heads up the House Intelligence Committee, has shown reluctance to throw support behind calls for impeachment, and might have to do in part with his particular history on the topic. Christina, what's his history with impeachment?
Sure. Well, you know, he effectively was able to win his seat in Congress thanks to impeachment. He unseated a Republican member who had been, you know, not just a supporter of impeachment, but ended up being one of the people who argued the case in the Senate. And
for Bill Clinton, by the way. Bill Clinton.
Sorry. Yes. For against President Clinton. And, you know, the district was starting to trend Democratic. And this was somebody who was looked at as a moderate Republican. But the move really angered a lot of his constituents. And what was interesting is it became this symbol of the national conversation about impeachment, yet at the same time in the district, you know, both Schiff and former Congressman Rogan say that this wasn't even an issue. This wasn't what people were asking about. They wanted to talk about local issues. And that's, we see that today. You know, the national media likes to make things seem like bellwethers. And, but that it does matter. And I think we're going to see that play out quite extensively over the next couple of months here.
Rafe, Nancy Pelosi has said that if the American people want President Trump out of the White House, they're going to have to do it at the polls. Do you think that now maybe we'll see a shift in messaging, political messaging, from maybe talk of impeachment and maybe more talk of policies?
You know, I don't know. The Democrats have tied themselves in knots with this impeachment question now for months. Mm-hmm. You know, can't do this, can't go forward, can't go backward. I think it's not right, though, or correct for her to say that all that's left is the election, because Congress still has an obligation to gather information, even in the face of the resistance of the Trump administration, that will allow the voters to make an informed decision. So it's not an all or nothing. It has always not been about impeachment. It has always been about investigation and about whether or not there is a way to break loose the information that will help the voters decide. And I think, in a way, I think they're maybe being a little too quick to say, let's just hand this all to the voters. They'll figure it out. But it's kind of a circular thing. The voters need information with which to figure things out.
But even Schiff has told Democrats, or he told them in 2016, that Democrats that are running for something, let me handle impeachment. I will handle that. You deal with putting food on the table. And is that a strategy that they should repeat again in 2020?
No, because 2018 and 2020 are not going to be the same election. Donald Trump is going to be on the ballot in 2020. You can't run necessarily the same campaign and say, we don't care who the president is. The important thing is health care. It's not going to work quite the same way. I think you have to address the elephant in the room, which is the reelection of the president is the fundamental question. I think Democrats in the House got themselves in a mess by telling their voters, don't worry, we'll handle impeachment, but then had difficulty investigating, which is the alternative to impeachment.
Rafe Sonnenschein directs the Pat Brown Institute at Cal State LA. Christina Bellantoni is professor at USC's Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism. Christina, Rafe, thanks a lot.
It was fun.
All right, things in this city are changing all the time. So even if you've lived your entire life here, it doesn't hurt to get some tips on how to LA. And with gas prices as high as they are, you might be thinking about ditching your car and pedaling to work instead. After you get that bike, what should you get next? Coming up, your second most important purchase to successfully cycle your way through LA. That's next in 60 seconds.
Podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth, an online hybrid tailored for working professionals with attendance only twice per term in West LA. Attend an info session to learn more. Classes start September 3rd. Apply by August 5th for up to $8,000 in scholarships at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. In an unprecedented move yesterday, the shareholders of all three California utility companies agreed to pay into a fund to help offset the costs of wildfires. This comes a year after the most destructive and deadliest blaze in the state's history, the Camp Fire. Now, in total, investors will pay $10.5 billion into the fund. The customers will pay $10.5 billion as well. Here to help us understand what led to this plan, we have Taryn Luna, staff writer for the LA Times covering the Capitol. Taryn, welcome back to Take Two.
Thanks for having me.
All right. For starters, why is this such a big deal?
It's a big deal because essentially this fund and this system retools the way California pays for wildfires. It's also a big deal to see the utilities put up a lot of money because of many have described in the before. I mean, this is not something that's happened before. Usually investors put up money with a guaranteed return on investment. And so for them to put $10.5 billion into a fund is a big deal in California.
Yeah, I got to admit, I was surprised because when you pay for something, it's almost like you're taking responsibility for something, too.
Right. And so this is a little bit different.
Yeah. Yes, yes, it is.
They got some clearances from responsibility for putting the money in.
Yeah. So, okay, so how is this wildfire fund going to work and who's involved?
So, of course, as you mentioned before, utilities put up $10.5 billion. That comes from shareholders. And customers put up the other $10.5 billion through an extension of a fee on utility bills. It's for investor-owned utility customers, right? So Edison and Southern California, San Diego Gas and Electric, and PG&E, and the larger portion of the state, those customers would see those bills. If you pay through, you know, LA or Sacramento utilities services, you wouldn't have to see that on your account at all. But the way it works, essentially, is if there's a wildfire in PG&E territory and its equipment was linked to that fire, they would have to tap into their insurance to cover the cost of that fire. But then for any costs that exceed insurance, they could go into this fund and use the money to pay off damages and pay off claims.
How long does the fund last? Do they pay it into perpetuity or to cover future wildfire costs?
So it's basically for 10 years that they're going to be paying into this. So there'll be an initial cost up front where the utilities will be splitting $7.5 billion off the bat. And then after that, they'll pay a portion of $300 million every year.
How did we wind up getting here, Taryn? Because what different pieces were at play that led to shareholders to agree to put this large of a sum of money into this fund?
I think there was a lot of pressure that came from Wall Street, in a sense, right? So after you had the major fire, the Camp Fire, there was a lot of concerns about how much liability would fall on PG&E for that and led PG&E to file for bankruptcy. And then you had the ratings agencies who were watching the California market and saying, you know, if PG&E is liable for $30 billion, that could happen to any of these other utilities. And so why would we be encouraging people to invest in this market if we know they're basically facing unlimited risk? So the rating agencies put a deadline, essentially. They told the legislature and the governor that they were going to downgrade the companies, SDG&E and Edison, the last two that are not in bankruptcy, if the legislature didn't act and do something to pass significant the legislation to significantly reduce the risk. And so the governor pushed them off until July 12th and said, you know, give us time until our recess comes, our summer recess hits, and we'll try to, you know, make some efforts on that. So I think for the legislature, it's something they haven't really wanted to do or they've been reluctant to really do in full over the years. But given that pressure from Wall Street and the reality that you could see Edison downgraded possibly, and then if another really bad fire hits in their territory, that they could possibly face bankruptcy like PG&E, that it really pushed people to take action.
Yeah, I was wondering, considering that you know, bankruptcy should mean that you don't have money, I was wondering how they're going to contribute to that fund.
So that's part of the issue with PG&E is they've signaled that they intend to participate in the fund. It still has to be cleared by the bankruptcy court. And then that investment that they have to put into the fund, right? So they're responsible for something like 64% of the $10.5 billion, which comes out to a little more than $6.7 billion. But that would also have to be cleared through the bankruptcy court, that investment.
Now, the other half of this, the other $10.5 billion, that's you, me, and everyone else listening, the utility customers, the utility company customers. Where does that leave us?
I mean, the legislature and the governor have really tried to argue that this isn't a tax increase because it's simply continuing a charge that's already on your utility bill from the last energy crisis in 2001. Critics, of course, and some ratepayer advocates say it's definitely a tax and it's definitely an increase. And they had to get a two-thirds vote in the legislature, which basically means that it's a tax increase, right? So for us, I mean, it ranges from, I saw some utility bills where it was a matter of cents for people who didn't have, didn't have AC and lived on the coast, and someone in a Long Beach apartment who, you know, they opened their windows and the sea was there, essentially AC unit. But then, you know, in suburban Northern California, it was significant, you know, $6, $7, $8 a month on the bill.
Oh, wow. So, yeah, that's a big difference then, depending on where you are.
It is. And so the idea is that this fee was going to sunset sometime next year, and now it'll be extended out. So, I mean, your utility bill isn't going to increase, but I guess it could have decreased if they didn't continue this.
That's Taryn Luna, staff writer at the LA Times, covering Gavin Newsom. Taryn, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, now let's hit the road. We've launched a new web series on LAist.com this week, giving practical advice on how to live, eat, play in LA. It's called How to LA. And one of the things you'll find, the first steps to take if you want to bike more around the city. Now, that's something one of our own producers has been thinking about, especially cycling to and from our Pasadena studio. But one thing has always held her back, confusion over what headgear to buy.
I'm Tamika Adams. I am a producer with KPCC, and we're right outside the Crawford Family Forum at the studios. And, you know, I just want to really start and get riding, but I'm not going to get on that bike unless I have a helmet. So I wanted to get some advice, and I thought I'd ask an experienced biker about helmet protection. So right here we're standing with Leo Duran.
How you doing? Yep,
How you doing?
I have my bike right here. I bike in every day.
So, Leo, why do you wear a helmet?
Well, it's one of the most important things that you can do for your own safety. I'm not afraid to be on my bike while on the roads, nor should I be, but it's just an extra measure I use.
So what are the things I should consider? You know, I really want to be smart about this purchase.
Okay, so I have my bike helmet right here.
Okay, I see it.
It is styrofoam. Now, I'm a little bit vain, so it's gray and it matches my bike,
sure.
So it's one thing. It also has a lot of vents on it because Los Angeles can be really hot.
I mean, yeah.
Now, it's actually not that simple, so I figured, you know, instead of just me trying to guess what you should look into,
okay.
Why don't we actually get some real advice, too?
Yeah, sounds great. Let's go.
Okay, so we are at a place where they actually have bike helmets where you can test them, REI, over in Arcadia. So let's go on in.
I'm excited. Let's do this. Air conditioning.
Here we are inside of REI. We're walking towards the bike section. And here's the aisle with all the bike helmets.
Oh my God, there's so many. Okay.
There's a huge wall of them. First off, I talked about how my bike helmet is gray to match my bike. Does color matter to you?
You know, I could also be vain and just try and find a purple helmet, but honestly, I care more about visibility.
Okay.
So a white or one of these neon yellow ones might work as well.
Okay, what about venting? Because I care about how hot and exhausted I get while biking. Does it matter to you how many there are?
I mean, it's a matter of protection for me, so I guess if that is or isn't a factor. But I do have a lot of hair.
Yep.
I don't want to have a sweaty head going into work. So if ventilation, it's going to be
because we all got to look good in the office.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Well, you do actually bring up a good point that I'm not too familiar about. If venting means that you'll stay cooler, but it means less protection. So I actually want to bring in somebody who knows more about helmets than I do.
Awesome.
This is Fitz. Actually, his name is Mike Fitzpatrick, but you can call him Fitz.
Lovely to meet you.
Good to meet you as well.
So Fitz, it seems a little overwhelming. So is there a difference between someone like me, who's like more casual biker, or someone who wears like neon colored spandex?
So let me start by saying this. This is the comforting part, if you will, when you're buying a helmet. Every helmet that's legally sold in the United States has to have a sticker on the inside from the Consumer Product Safety Commission. I'll show you where they are here.
Okay.
It's a little teeny tiny sticker here. And if it's got that sticker on it, it is just as safe, whether it's a $45 helmet or it's a $300 helmet.
How important is fit?
Most important thing.
Okay, yep. Great. Yep.
I always use the terms low, level, snug, and stable. By low, I mean that we're going to look for a helmet that, while still being comfortable, is sitting as low as possible. So if you were to get in an accident, it's going to cover more of your head. If you can put two fingers between the top of your forehead and the bottom of the helmet,
okay.
That's about right. Any more than that, it's not sitting low enough on your head. Level, when you put it on, should be level to the ground, more or less. Snug, so we're looking for a helmet that is touching your head evenly all the way around.
So I have a lot of hair, Fitz. That's
yeah.
Like a concern. So how can I ensure that it's fitting snugly all the way around, like having as much hair as I do?
For some women, especially if they're putting their hair back in a ponytail. Well,
yeah, like I have mine today.
You may sometimes have to pull the ponytail down a little bit under the bottom of the back of the helmet.
Sure.
But we'll definitely take that into consideration. Your last one is stable. Stable simply means that it can't move around in your head a lot. I just pulled this one out. I know you had mentioned going with something kind of neon. I'll just...
So maybe like sure. I'm seeing this white one with a visor right here. You know, and I had a concern because I was looking online for a helmet. So would you recommend that someone come into store and really try on a few?
I always recommend someone trying them on.
Okay,
sure.
Great. So let's pop this guy on.
Is there anything anywhere on the head, the front, the back, sides, very top, that feels out of place?
I don't even have the straps on yet.
Correct.
And it feels like it's gonna stay on my head even if I move around.
So on the tightness of the strap, what you're looking for is a situation where it's loose enough that you could have conversation when you're riding, but if you fully open your mouth, it should pull down on the top of your head just slightly.
I feel it moving as I like open my jaw, okay. Yeah. All right, let's start smacking
head. Let's do some shake, exactly. Shake that head.
All right, I have an earring in the way.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's solid.
Did you want to try it anymore?
I really like this one.
Okay.
It's a very good fit.
No, I think it looks really good.
Yeah?
I'm just making sure that, you didn't swipe right too fast. That you try some others, but
quickly.
If you're into it, you stick with it.
Okay, let's cool. Go get a couple of bikes and go ride around.
I know, right?
Oh.
All right, rolling through the parking lot. We got it! Hooray!
That's KPCC's Tamika Adams, and for the first time, she biked into work this morning.
So how was my bike ride today? It was actually quite leisurely, aside from the fact that it's already 90 degrees at 8 a.m.
Hey, you took the bike ride. You can find her out and about in Pasadena now with that bright white helmet. And check out more of our first-timer's guide to biking in L.A. It's part of our series How to L.A. on LAist.com. Southern California is one of the few places in the world where it's possible to ski and surf all on the same day. And even though it's the last weekend in July, there's still time to do just that. Coming up, find out where exactly you can still pull off that rare LA double play. That's next when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC, Amy Martinez. Hang 10 this weekend or watch some experts at the U.S. Open of Surfing in Huntington Beach. That whooping at the end there belongs to Kanoa Iragashi, who won last year's competition along with Courtney Conlogue in just 3-foot waves. Not an easy feat. This weekend, the Open celebrates its 60th anniversary, but it's no longer just for surfers. For this year, the event will expand on how much there is for skaters and BMX riders. Here's Justin Villano from Vans, the Open's main sponsor.
We're going to be introducing BMX Rebel Jam, which is a new competitive platform. It'll be on a street course.
And that's in addition to the bowls, think empty swimming pools that were features of past Opens.
Is really celebrating creativity, style, fun, and the culture itself.
And Villano says that expansion is a direct response to the X Games leaving Southern California in 2013. The Open wanted to give the right showcase to those sports. Another change for this year's Open is for female competitors. One, it's going to be the first time in 14 years that competing women will be able to qualify for the World Surf League. And second, the prize money from this week's competition will match what the men can win. Here's Villano again.
We feel strongly that we need to continue to reward and elevate the women in action sports. Action sports has no barriers and passes no judgment. So for us, we want to make sure that we are enabling creative expression through action sports.
The week-long competition begins tomorrow with its youth challengers. So when you head out, it'll be a good way to beat the heat by heading to Surf City, USA.
Let's go surfing now, everybody's learning how. Come on a safari with me. Come on a safari with me. Early in the morning we'll be starting out. Some honeys will be coming along.
If it's too hot for you to go to the beach this weekend, you can also hit the slopes. That's right. For skiers and snowboarders, this year's powder has been incredible. Although winter's rains produced an epic amount of snow, so much that many of the slopes at Mammoth Mountain in Central California are still open. After this weekend, it's finally closing for the season. To tell us more about who was skiing all the way up until now, we have Lauren Burke. She's Communications Director for Mammoth Resorts. Lauren, welcome to Take Two.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure. All right, let's start with some pretty mind-blowing numbers. How much snow did Mammoth get this year?
Yeah, so it's been an incredible season up here at Mammoth. We opened in early November, and like you said, we are closing this Sunday on the 28th. We picked up almost 500 inches of snow here at our main lodge, which is our base lodge, and then at our 11,053-foot summit, we received 718 inches of snow.
When you saw all this snow coming down, you knew what this meant. I mean, what were you guys thinking up there? Like, oh my God, I can't believe this.
Honestly, here in Mammoth, this is what we live for. We live for the seasons like this where it snows and doesn't stop. And Mammoth is really unique from other resorts where we will stay open as long as conditions allow. So a lot of other resorts have a very set opening date and closing date. But here at Mammoth, if we can open early, if we can stay open later, we're going to do it. We're all skiers and snowboarders, and this has been one of those seasons.
How does this season compare to previous years?
So we are tied for our third longest season on record. We actually stayed open in the 16-17 season until August 6th. We stayed open until, I think it was August 13th before. So July 28th is close for one of the longest seasons on record. It's not there yet. But Mammoth has been open into July over 15 times. So if we can do it, we'll do it.
Talking to Lauren Burke, Communications Director for Mammoth Resorts. All right, now Mammoth will close for this year's skiing and snowboarding season on Sunday. But tell us, Lauren, who's up there right now?
The skiers and snowboarders who are up here right now is kind of our diehard crowd. These are the people that are committed to skiing as many days as they can in a season. And it's also the people that are kind of doing it for the novelty of it. They come up here, they see that they can still be skiing. They'll ski for an hour or two in the morning and then maybe go ride their mountain bike or go golfing and fishing in the afternoon. It's kind of that special time of year where you can really do it all up here.
So I can imagine, though, Lauren, that because it's at the highest elevations that are still open, you got to be pretty experienced, pretty skillful to be still doing all that stuff.
Definitely. It is, for the most part, expert-only terrain that's open. Like you said, it is the upper part of the mountain that's open right now, that high-elevation slopes, our black diamond, double black diamond run. So it's definitely not the right time of year if you're learning to ski or snowboard to come up here. But if you're an experienced skier, it's going to be very fun on the mountain this weekend.
Out of curiosity, how do conditions on the slopes change from winter to spring to summer?
Yeah, you know, it's really an interesting progression of kind of snow texture and quality as the season moves on. Midwinter, it's kind of that cold, light, you know, like the true midwinter snow. And then as you move into spring, the snow warms up. We call it corn snow. So it's really soft, carvable snow. And now that we're in midsummer, the corn snow gets even softer. It's great first thing in the morning, and then it continues to warm up as the day goes on.
Now, if someone didn't know that this is the last weekend, well, now they do if they're listening. What sorts of crowds are you expecting this weekend?
Yeah, you know, we've had a couple hundred skiers every day in July, so we are expecting a pretty busy day on the slopes. People are really coming out to celebrate the long season with us. We have some great giveaways going on Sunday to celebrate the summer skiing. But then after we wrap midday on Sunday, we expect our skiers to kind of hit the bike park, go for a hike. So it's going to be a day where you can do it all.
Any chance you might be able to extend it another week, maybe go for that record?
You know, we wanted to do it so bad. We want to stay open year-round some season if we can. But as you guys know, it has been hot the last couple of weeks, and that snowpack deteriorates really quickly. So Sunday's the day to get it in.
Lauren Burke is Communications Director for Mammoth Resorts, where the ski slopes are still open through Sunday. Lauren, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you so much.
All right, if I had to pick one dish for my final meal on this earth, it would be pretty difficult to top lomo saltado. Strips of sirloin stir-fried with onions, tomatoes, and French fries, all served with steaming hot white rice. It pretty much hits all the right flavor notes, food fusion at its finest, and this particular weekend in LA is the perfect time to treat yourself. Find out why and where when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC, I'm A. Martinez. It was almost 200 years ago on July 28th that Peru won its independence from Spain. And in Los Angeles on Sunday, the Peruvian community here will celebrate with a big festival of music and dance and, of course, a whole lot of good stuff to eat. LA has the second largest Peruvian community in the United States after New Jersey. And as Take-Two contributor Beto Arcos found out, food is at the heart of it.
At the home of guitarist Angelo Salazar in Northridge, he and percussionist Gino Gamboa are practicing one of the tunes they'll be playing this weekend at the Peruvian Fest. Salazar is the founder and leader of the group Chacombo.
We've established this group for about 2 years now, and what we do is we're just cultivating the Afro-Peruvian culture, mainly focusing on the music and the dance.
Salazar was born in Lima, Peru's capital, and his family came to LA in 1991. He's been playing the guitar for more than 20 years. Salazar's bandmate, Gino Gamboa, has lived in LA for 30 years, and he plays one of the most emblematic instruments from Peru, the cajon. The cajon is a rectangular wooden box that's played while sitting on top of it. Gamboa slaps the front of the instrument with his hands and fingers, bringing out the different textures and sounds. He's playing two different styles of Afro-Peruvian music. He plays with chacombo, first the upbeat festejo, and then the sensual landó. Gamboa started the first cajon festival and competition in L.A., even before Peru had such a thing.
Yes. So in Peru, you know, sometimes it happens when we are in our countries, we don't realize how rich, you know, are the things that we have around.
According to data from the last census in 2010, there are almost 28,000 Peruvians living in LA County. But local publisher Luis Rubianes believes the population is much larger across the region. He says that's just a small sample. In reality, it's five times bigger than that. Rubianes is owner, editor, and publisher of the monthly newspaper Última Hora. He and his assistant are delivering the paper at one of the distribution sites, Charlie's Grill Peruvian Restaurant in North Hollywood.
Buenas tardes.
¿Cómo está, Beto? Sube, sube, hermano, sube. Acá está más fresquito que abajo. Sube, sube. ¿Cómo estás?
Muy bien.
Rubianes stays in the van while his assistant drops off the load of newspapers at the restaurant. His stats aren't official, but he says the growth in LA County and Orange County can be measured by the number of restaurants, which have been increasing every day. He says there are more Peruvian restaurants now, and the main market that sustains them in the beginning is the Peruvian community, which is the one who knows the food. Food like causa, a mashed potato terrine, and chaufa de mariscos, rice with seafood. Rubianes is pretty familiar with the food scene here. Many of the 500 distribution points for his newspaper are in Peruvian restaurants. It takes him two full days to distribute 70,000 newspapers across L.A. and Orange County. Over the last decade, Peruvian restaurants have made a lasting impact in the food culture across the region.
But then one day when he came to the restaurant...
That's Miriam Ramirez, owner of Lonzo's Peruvian Restaurant and Bakery in Culver City, recalling the visit by famed LA Times food critic, the late Jonathan Gold, in January of 2016.
I remember that day when my nephew, who at that time was working there, he called me and he said, "Oh, tía, a lot of people are calling. They are making reservations. We're in the newspaper."
She says her life changed for the better after Gold came in and reviewed one of her best dishes, Sivas ceviche, and mentioned others like lomo saltado, a classic meal of stir-fried sirloin, onions, and French fries. Diners started to come from all over. Not only Peruvians or other Latin Americans, but the population at large.
It's a lot of diversity. No Asian people, Anglo people that come and taste our food. I think it's a boom the last 5 years about that developed that curiosity about the Peruvian food.
For guitarist Angelo Salazar and percussionist Gino Gamboa, it's now time to eat. After finishing their rehearsal, they go to lunch nearby at a Peruvian restaurant in Chatsworth called Fina Estampa. Salazar passes around anticuchos, beef hearts on a skewer, and talks about the origin of the food as a kind of metaphor for the Peruvian community.
This is the ingenuity of the Afro-Peruvian culture, the women, showing their strength to make something delicious out of the heart, something that has become a delicacy now. Even in the highest place of the world, they eat it now. You know what I mean? That's resistance. That's how it goes together, the music, the dance, the food.
And all of it is happening this Sunday at the Peruvian Festival. For Take Two, I'm Beto Arcos.
You can celebrate Peru's independence with all the flavors of Peruvian culture. The festival takes place this Sunday at Plaza de la Raza in Lincoln Park. Finally, in addition to that Peruvian fest, there's a lot more to do this weekend.
I'm KPCC's Leo Duran and A. Martinez. There are also songs and laughs to be had this weekend, but I'm actually going to start off with some other great food events.
Okay, cool.
So first off, the city of Santa Ana turns 150.
Wow.
Yeah, she looks pretty good for her age, right?
She must have had some work done.
It's LA. Of course she's had work done. Well, to celebrate, the city continues its great tradition with a street breakfast on Sunday morning. You can mingle with your neighbors while enjoying pancakes, chilaquiles, or vegan migas. There's lots to do after you stuff yourself, too. There'll be arts and crafts vendors, live music and dancing, loteria games, and more. This happens near the intersection of 4th and Spurgeon Streets, and tickets are $10.
All right, so what if I'm in a dinner mood?
Well, then you're going to need to head to Silver Lake for a pancit party. That's that Filipino noodle dish, and the love for it crosses cultures. This party is to celebrate the grand opening of this restaurant. It's called Spoon and Pork, and it spawned out of this popular food truck. So it's going to be this modern, casual place. When you go, you'll get complimentary pancit with the purchase of any dish. There'll also be music and giveaways throughout the day, too.
All right, that's a lot of food. What if I want to burn some of that calories off?
Yeah, well, it's going to be warm out there, so it's a great reason to get out there and exercise as long as you're staying cool. So you can go for a bike ride tomorrow along the LA River, then stop at Spoke Bicycle Cafe right off the path. That's because it's their 4-year anniversary. So I was actually just there a couple weekends ago. For people who haven't been, it's this great outdoor space to get food, coffee, or beer and wine. Bonus, in addition to the party, there's going to be the next installment of the Frogtown Show. That's their bi-monthly free comedy show. And this edition features Brooks Wheelan, Sarah Schaefer, and more. And when you go to this one, it's free.
All right, what about a way to cool off?
Well, then you can do it with some cool tunes.
Care for me.
All right, so yes, on Sunday, this lovely lady gets a tribute concert. It's a celebration of Ella Fitzgerald, and it happens at Galleria Chapel in Inglewood. Grammy-nominated singer Barbara Morrison curates an afternoon of jazz featuring Monica Mibi Dobi, Janice Mann, and Pat Sly. It's first-come, first-served seating, and this one's free. Now, there's actually so much more going on here this weekend, eh? Check out the fullest of events on LAIST.com. That is LAIST.com. And follow me on Twitter, at Leo Has a Cat.
That's KPCC's Leo Duran. Leo, thanks.
See you later, eh?
All right, that's it for Take Two this week. Our producers are Lori Skywalker Galaretta, Janaki Mehta. Tamika Adams is our news apprentice. Brandon Young is our intern. Austin Cross directed the show. And Hazmik Pogosian is our engineer. Leo Duran is this week's managing producer. If you missed any part of the show today, yesterday, the day before, you're in luck. You can always find it wherever you find your podcast. So make sure you look for the Take Two show wherever you find your podcast. You can also find us on social media. We're at Take Two. That's at Take Two. And I'm on Twitter and Instagram. Same social media. Media address for your convenience at A Martinez LA. That's at A Martinez LA. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back Monday at 2. Talk to you then.